I'll want to thank both of our speakers, but I'd also like to give a specific thanks to Professor Eric Guven, who is our moderator. He's the director of the Winnick Law and Business Center and agreed to step in at the last minute to moderate today's debate on compulsory unionism and the First Amendment, whether or not they're compatible. So get your chicken and enjoy, and without any further delay, I will hand over the program to Dean Guven.
Okay.
You've got those, right?
Thank you, Isaac. Welcome to a series of debates that Isaac has been doing an awesome job bringing to us here in the community. It's a nice follow-up today talking about labor issues after yesterday we had, as our Clayson speaker, Wilma Liebman, who is the chair of the National Labor Relations Board. So having opportunities to think about the relationship between management and labor, about industrial labor relations, I think is it's an important thing. It's something that we don't always stop to think about. But for someone like me, I'm looking forward to this debate, having grown up in a union household myself. My dad was a member of the International Union of Operating Engineers, and I know as a kid, I benefited greatly. I had one of nine children from the health benefits, the dental benefits that we had in the house, and that when my dad retired, the benefits that they enjoyed, both he and my mom, were substantial, and we wouldn't have had them without the union. My mom was a waitress, and at one point in her working career, she reported her employer for a violation of a labor law and was promptly fired. So I've seen what happens when you don't have a union. But I've also seen some other things. My younger brother was a plumber. He had gone to vocational school for plumbing. And when he got out of school, he got a job in the shipyard as a pipe fitter and could not really make a go of it, because my brother was told early on in the shop that he was working too hard, and that if he did this much or that much, something might happen, like an accident could happen to him, and that would be unfortunate. So my brother quit the shipyard and went to work for a non-union contractor building houses. My dad, a lifelong union man, didn't speak to my brother for months after that. But I think it presented an issue within the family and perhaps within a larger context about the good points and the bad points of unions. I mean, we all, I think, can recognize in the abstract that there are unscrupulous employers out there who will take advantage of folks who don't bind together and negotiate from a position of strength. But there's also going to be situations where that unit takes advantage of the system and doesn't police itself well and does feather bedding. So it's a mixed blessing at best. These two folks today are going to present both sides of one aspect of the labor relations issue, that of compulsory union membership or closed shops versus open shops, apparently. It's a treat today because it's an all French Canadian panel from your moderator, and your two discussants are both of Quebecois lineage. So let me first introduce Mr. Ray LaJeunesse. He's the Vice President and Legal Director for the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. Mr. LaJeunesse is the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation is a nonprofit legal aid organization. He's the first staff attorney employed by the foundation and has been there for 39 years, helping workers in litigation in federal and state courts and administrative agencies. Mr. LaJeunesse has argued four cases in the United States Supreme Court. Those cases include Leonard versus Ferris Faculty Association, which limited the purposes for which compulsory union fees collected from public employees may be lawfully spent; Airline Pilots Association versus Miller, which established that unions cannot compel non-members to exhaust union-established remedies before going to court to challenge compulsory union fees; and Marquez versus Screen Actors Guild, in which the court recognized that unions must notify employees that they can satisfy the membership requirement of a union shop agreement by just paying fees for union bargaining activities and need not join and pay full dues to keep their jobs. He was also lead attorney in Hone versus Casey, in which more than $8.3 million in compulsory agency fees were recovered from the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees for a class of 57,000 non-members. Mr. Lajeunesse is the author of several published articles about labor law, has testified before congressional committees several times, and was an advisor on the transition team for labor-related agencies, Office of the President-elect in 1980-81, and a legislative aide to a member of the Virginia State Legislature. He's vice chairman of the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group and has spoken or debated at the Society's National Lawyers Convention and at many lawyers and student chapters on topics such as right-to-work laws, compulsory unionism, agreements, the misuse of union dues for politics, union organizing tactics, and the future of the union movement. On the other side of this debate is Mr. Ron Patnaud. Mr. Patnaud is president of UAW Local 2322, representing and assisting 3,200 workers in the fields of early and higher education and healthcare in their fight for fair wages and benefits and safe working conditions. Ron was first elected as president of UAW 2322 in 2004 and is currently serving his third three-year term. Ron joined the union and the local in 1998 when he and his co-workers at an area hospital organized and voted to affiliate with the UAW after the agency had cut wages and benefits and working conditions had become dangerous and intolerable. Ron had worked as an alcohol and substance abuse counselor and mental health counselor at the facility since 1993. After joining the UAW local, he became a shop steward and served as the co-chair and joint counsel representative for his shop and as the UAW civil rights chairperson for Massachusetts. In 2006, Ron won the Pioneer Valley Labor Leader of the Year Award for his efforts on behalf of working people in the community. He's been very involved politically for years and worked on the first campaign to elect Deval Patrick Governor of the Commonwealth. In addition to his work for the members of the UAW 2322, he currently serves on the Commonwealth Corporation Board of Directors, which oversees fundings for job training in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So this should be an interesting discussion. The ground rules are going to be 15 minutes aside. I'll keep time. 5 minutes rebuttal per side. Okay?
Thank you, and thank you to the chapter for inviting me to participate in this debate today. I don't have time to explain what the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation is, but there are brochures on the coffee tables in the back if you'd like to pick one up, giving more information about the foundation. It's my contention that compulsory unionism cannot be reconciled with the First Amendment, freedoms of speech and association. Now, what am I talking about when I say compulsory unionism? There are two types. The first is what is called in labor relations law exclusive representation, what I would like to call monopoly bargaining. And that is that if you go to work in a bargaining unit represented by a union that's been selected by a majority of the employees in that bargaining unit, you cannot negotiate your own contract with the employer. You're represented by that union even if you don't want it. This clearly infringes on freedom of contract, clearly infringes on freedom of association. Unfortunately, the United States Supreme Court has upheld the constitutionality of monopoly bargaining, though I would contend by sleight of hand. Going back on the history, in 1937, the issue of the constitutionality of monopoly bargaining came before the court in two cases, the Virginia Railway case and Jones and Laughlin, the first under the Railway Labor Act, the second under the National Labor Relations Act. And the plaintiffs in that case were employers only. So there were no employee plaintiffs to assert their rights and their interests. That's number one, the problem with those cases. And secondly, in those cases, the court said all that exclusive representation means is that the employer cannot negotiate a contract with another representative of employees, can only negotiate with the exclusive representative. But the court explicitly said that the individual employees could still work out their own contracts. Well, the court pulled the ground out from underneath the employees in 1944 in another case called J.I. Case. This was a National Labor Relations Act case. No constitutional questions were presented in this case, and the court there overruled what it had said in the Jones and Laughlin case and said that individual contracts are not permitted, that the individual employee, even if he doesn't want to join the union, even if he doesn't like the union, is bound by whatever the union works out for him. He cannot represent himself. constitutionality of that system was raised in a case called Steele in 1944 under the Railway Labor Act, but the court again ducked the issue and said, we're not going to reach the constitutional question because we hold that the union has a duty to represent all of the employees in the bargaining unit fairly, quote unquote. Well, that's a pretty vague standard, and as turned out in the cases since, that it's a very loose standard and has resulted in discrimination against employees who don't want to be represented by the union. The court finally, sort of, addressed the issue in a public sector case brought by the foundation that the court considered in 1983 called Knight. And in this case, the issue was whether public sector monopoly bargaining violates the First Amendment. And the court summarily upheld a decision of a lower court saying that monopoly bargaining in the public sector does not violate the First Amendment. The lower court had, and this was without opinion, the court didn't explain its reasoning. The lower court had relied on a case, also a foundation case, called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, but Abood didn't even raise the issue of exclusive representation. The only issue in Abood was the issue of forced fees, to which I'll turn next. Adding insult to injury, under most of the labor statutes in this country, if you are represented by a union you don't want and cannot negotiate your own contracts, you are also required to pay money to that union. This is called the union shop. And in fact, it's not really a union shop, and I'll explain that. Closed shops, by the way, are prohibited. Closed shops are agreements where you have to be a union member to get a job. Those are unlawful under all of the federal and state labor statutes. Union shops are appear to be authorized by the National Labor Relations Act and the Railway Labor Act. That is, those statutes say employers and unions can enter into contracts requiring you to be a member to keep your job. After a certain period, when you've been hired, you have so many days to join the union. However, the court has, and obviously that would be infringing on your freedom of association and speech. Freedom in the, of association, in the sense you're required to join a union that you don't want. Speech, because you're required to pay dues, and those dues can be used by the union for purposes to which you object. However, the court, under both the National Labor Relations Act and the Railway Labor Act, has interpreted the statutes as not requiring full union membership, only the payment of a dues equivalent. This happened in 1954 and 1963 under the National Labor Relations Act in cases called Radio Officers Union and General Motors. In those cases, the Supreme Court interpreted a proviso that was added to the Wagner Act in 1947 by the Taft-Hartley Act that prohibits the use of the union shop to compel formal membership. You can only be required to pay dues. And there's a significant difference, because if you are a union member, you're bound by the union constitution and whatever it authorizes. You're bound by the decisions of the union officers as to how they want to spend the money, including spending money for politics. And you are bound by union rules and can be disciplined for violating those union rules. For example, if you cross a picket line during a strike, you can be fined by the union, and those fines are court enforceable. So that was a significant advancement for freedom in the sense that no longer can employees be required to actually join the union and be subject to union discipline. And then, in a series of cases from a case called Hansen under the Railway Labor Act in 1956 to a case called Communications Workers Beck versus Beck in 1988. That was another case brought by the foundation attorneys for workers. The court explicitly acknowledging that even requiring payment of money to a union as a condition of employment raises significant First Amendment questions, infringes on First Amendment rights. The court upheld that infringement, only as to the union's costs of collective bargaining and contract administration. The court held, to avoid constitutional questions again, that the Railway Labor Act and the National Labor Relations Act authorize collection of forced dues only for collective bargaining and contract administration purposes. They are prohibited by the statutes for use for politics, lobbying, ideological causes, and other non-bargaining activities. Well, in 1977, the court reached the same result with regard to public sector employees in the foundation case, Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. The public sector cases present clear constitutional issues because the agreement is between a governmental body and a union. And the First Amendment applies directly. And the court held in Abood that the First Amendment prohibits force fees for political and ideological purposes, but allowed it for bargaining and contract administration purposes, even though once again it recognized that the collection, even for bargaining purposes, infringes on First Amendment speech and association. Finally, for our purposes, in 1986, in a case called Hudson, again a public sector case, the court held that certain procedural protections have to be provided by unions for non-members to allow them to prevent use of their money for politics and other non-bargaining purposes. Those procedural protections include an advance reduction of the fee to only lawfully chargeable purposes, notice of that reduction, and an opportunity to challenge the calculation. That notice has to include an independent audit of the calculation, and the employees have to have the opportunity to challenge the calculation before an impartial decision maker. And while that's going on, the monies have to be escrowed. However, it's my contention that in practice, these decisions do not prevent First Amendment violations. That is, they do not prevent forced association and forced speech. The Marquez case was mentioned by our moderator. In that case, although the court said unions have a duty to tell employees about their rights, you can imagine how often that happens in practice. Private sector contracts can say that membership is required as a condition of employment. Clearly, this is misleading. Individual employees, they see the word member in their contract. If the union steward says, see what the contract says, you've got to join the union, or their supervisor says you have to join the union because it says member, employees are forced into full membership. Obviously, misrepresentation can occur even where the supervisor or the union steward knows what membership really means in law, but not in the common understanding of the term. There are also a number of procedural hurdles that employees have to get over in order to exercise their rights under the Supreme Court's decisions. Unfortunately, in a 1961 case called Street under the Railway Labor Act, the court was faced with a situation where the plaintiffs and the members of their bargaining unit were all members of the union because they didn't understand that member didn't mean member at that early time. And so you had some of the class members in the bargaining unit who are voluntary members who obviously have no right to tell the union that they don't want their money spent for politics, and others were involuntary members who do have that right. And the court therefore said, quote, dissent is not to be presumed, end quote. That's fairly logical. We don't, unless you tell us, we don't know whether you're a voluntary or involuntary member. Unfortunately, the lower courts and the National Labor Relations Board have applied that phrase, dissent is not to be presumed, not only to people who are involuntary members of the union, but to non-members who've already said, I don't want anything to do with this union. And so lower courts have upheld union requirements that before you can pay less than full dues, you have to tell them that you object. Well, they've also upheld window periods for stating that you object. Narrow periods, usually a month or 3 weeks, at that one time, you can tell them. If you find out after the window period's gone by that the union's spending money on something you don't like and you're a non-member, you can't object according to these rulings. And the courts have also upheld the union notice being put in a union, what I would call a propaganda reg, that is a union newspaper or magazine extolling the union, talking about the union's politics. Non-members aren't going to want to read that. They're offended by the union. So they're never going to find out about their rights if they're buried, but nonetheless, the courts have allowed that. And finally, not making it even worse, at the moment, though hopefully this will, we're litigating this in a number of cases, at the moment the courts and the National Labor Relations Board are divided on whether the unions can require you to object once a year, every year. In other words, if you say, I don't want to support your politics, this is a continuing objection, the courts, in some cases, have allowed the union to say, too bad, you missed it next year, you missed that window period next year, you have to pay full dues. In addition, the BEC, that is the right to pay less than full dues, and the Hudson rights, the procedural rights, are difficult to enforce. Think about it. You've got the fox guarding the hen house. Who keeps the records of how the union spends the money? The unions. Who determines what is chargeable and what is not in the first instance when they send out that notice to the non-members saying you can object? The union. It's audited, but the audit only looks at whether the union spent the money the way it sent the money, the way it says it spent the money, not whether the union has correctly allocated it between lawfully chargeable and non-chargeable activities. And obviously, the union has a self-interest in maximizing the percentage that it claims is chargeable and collects from non-members. The only way to unravel the situation is for the non-member to bring a lawsuit. Those lawsuits are protracted, complex, and expensive. They have to hire attorneys and accountants. For that reason, way back in the street in 1961, the Justice Black said in his dissent, when they interpreted the statute as limiting the amount that could be collected, said the statute should simply be declared unconstitutional because it is impossible for employees to effectively exercise their rights. The only real solution to this problem is right-to-work laws, which are permitted under the National Labor Relations Act in effect in 22 states. These laws prohibit compulsory membership. They prohibit compulsory fees. These completely protect against forced association and speech. The rights of employees under them are simple to exercise. All they have to do is refrain from joining in the first place, or if they've joined and then find out they don't like what the union is doing, resign and revoke their dues deduction authorization. These statutes are easily enforced. You can see a violation. It's easy to see when a union is compelling somebody to join as a condition of employment. And they're clearly constitutional. Most recently, in 2007, in another foundation case, the Davenport case, the Supreme Court said that right-to-work laws are constitutional, that unions have no constitutional right to collect monies from non-members, that it's only a statutory right. Thank you.
Good afternoon, sisters and brothers. In the labor movement, we refer to one another as sisters and brothers, not out of any familial ties, but rather because of the struggles we have shared as workers and union members. Those struggles often include organizing drives to help non-unionized workers to organize, form, and join the union of their own choosing as guaranteed under Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act. Or we could serve on a bargaining committee working for a fair contract for our coworkers, or acting as a steward representing coworkers, or even being on a picket line together supporting other workers in their struggle to join a union, or showing solidarity by walking a picket line with striking workers. Excuse me. None of those activities are forced on anyone, and frankly can't be. The idea of forced unionism is another red herring being offered by an anti-union, anti-worker, ideological group like the National Right to Work Foundation. They should be called the National Right to Work for Less Foundation. Wait, we do say that. All one has to do is look at who funds the organization to get an idea of why they are out doing the dirty work for their corporate friends. For your convenience, I've taken the liberty of making copies of some of that information, which is readily available on the web. We'll put those on the same table with the pamphlets from the National Right to Work Foundation afterwards. The foundation talks about a worker's right not to have to join a union, but never addresses the reason why about two-thirds of workers polled say they would vote to join a union if they had the opportunity. What are those reasons, you might ask yourself? Well, let me tell you. It's what we call the union advantage. A union worker's median weekly earnings are 28% higher than a non-union worker's median weekly earnings. For women, those numbers are 34% higher earnings, African Americans 29%, and Latinos 50%. Unionized workers also have four times more likely to have employer-provided health insurance than non-unionized workers. Unionized workers have safer working conditions because unions often have health and safety committees to monitor safety conditions at the work site. And also, frankly, unionized workers are more likely to report safety violations without fear of retaliation by the employer because they have a union. It's a shame that the 29 miners killed in the Upper Branch, Big Branch mine disaster in Virginia, West Virginia earlier this year didn't have a union. Perhaps their deaths could have been avoided. That tragedy, by the way, was the country's worst mine disaster in four decades and a testament to the Bush doctrine of industries being self-regulated or policed. The foundation also never in any way addresses issues of workplace fairness, pay equity, safety, or any other issue than their singular goal to fight workers' rights to have a union. That is their corporate backers' goal, and that is their only purpose, to undermine unions and their members' rights. As to the assertion or theory that unions are incompatible with the First Amendment, I'm puzzled as to what grounds that claim is being made. There are already protections, as the gentleman pointed out, and there's actually a clause within the National Labor Relations Act which allows and guarantees an individual's right not to participate in concerted activity or join a union. Unions are democratically run organizations, and just like our political system, no one is forced to participate. Workers who choose to become union members have a voice and a vote. I serve at the pleasure of my membership, who vote me in or out every 3 years. To be clear, in states like Massachusetts, which is not a right to shirk state, we like to call them, shirk their responsibilities to their employees and to workers, which Dr. King put best by saying it provides neither rights nor work. A union is allowed in a workplace at which the membership has bargained and voted to ratify a provision within the collective bargaining agreement that requires that an employee pay the percentage of dues for the cost of the union for representational activities, as Ray pointed out. This is known as an agency fee. Those same individuals also have, receive all the wages, benefits, and the safer working conditions that their union co-workers receive. That is allowed because under the law, even though an employee may not wish to join, belong, or participate in the union, and is allowed to refrain from such activities, the union is obligated to represent that individual in the event that they need union representation. And you can believe me when I tell you that I have represented numerous folks over the years that didn't have any use for a union until they found themselves in a jackpot, meaning in trouble. I don't know about all of you, but I don't think folks should be able to not pay their taxes, say, if they don't like who the president is, as an example, or maybe not pay property taxes if they don't have children, and I say that as someone who has no children. If they're receiving services, it seems only logical that they should have to pay for those services, and that's all an agency fee does, is allow for that collection of that percentage of dues. On that note, the idea that unions are somehow not democratic because perhaps everyone who is eligible to vote in a union election does not, and the number of votes cast decides the outcome and non-voters are not counted, is absurd. If that's the argument, I would like to retroactively rescind George Bush Jr.'s two terms, as he clearly did not receive a plurality of the eligible votes. Also, contrary to the myth that unions are somehow secretive or shady in how they handle members' dues is asinine. Unions have to provide more documentation than any corporations do. We have to file what is known as an LM2, which among other things requires that every minute I or my staff work is broken down into five different categories, and that's where these chargeable categories come into play that Ray talked about. We also have an executive board and a joint council who have to approve expenditures above a certain amount. We also have to have two signatories, and we have to have biannual trustee reports that are required. Perhaps if the financial institutions and other corporate gluttons who caused the worst fiscal crisis since the Great Depression had half the reporting requirements that unions are subject to, we would not have been thrown into this mess, while those responsible still continue to get their ill-gotten gains. In closing, the National Labor Relations Act was created to help restore labor peace during a very volatile time after the Great Depression and to allow for a way to solve labor disputes with as little disruption to production as possible. It did not level the playing field, but it gave, at least gave workers a decent shot at forming and joining a union if they chose to do so. It has in the last 40 years been chipped away at, and now in a quarter of organizing drives, employers illegally fire at least one worker to chill the campaign. If you'd like to talk about a violation of the First Amendment, I think that having your job taken away from you because you talk about a union or you want to join a union or your employer is allowed to fire you, and the remedy is if you're lucky, you'll get your job back in a couple of years with maybe some back pay, is a real violation of the First Amendment, ladies and gentlemen. Regardless of all this, workers still take the risk every day to form and join unions, and it is because unions are still the best means by which workers can improve their wages, benefits, and working conditions. They are also still one of the best examples of our great country's democratic principles put into action. I thank you very much. And I will put the stuff out on the table after.
Mr. Legionis, you have 5 minutes rebuttal.
Well, first of all, we're not talking about whether people have a right to join or not join unions. They clearly do. In fact, one of the major cases on which we reply in arguing that individuals shouldn't be forced to join unions is a case called Thomas v. Collins, in which the Supreme Court upheld the right of folks to join unions. The point is, the court also said in that case that they have a right not to join under the First Amendment. Right-to-work laws don't prevent individuals from joining unions or obtaining exclusive representation. All they prevent is forced payment of money and forced membership. And where a union is voluntary, it has to work harder to represent its members and the other employees in the bargaining unit, and people will join it if it's doing a good job. The foundation is not anti-worker. We are anti-union. We are anti-compulsory unionism. Our funding comes from workers, individual citizens through direct mail and telemarketing, yes, some corporations, mostly small businesses, and some foundations, other foundations. And we don't try to stop people from joining unions. What we say is you have to be a voluntary member. Higher earnings. The statistics on which Ron relies do not factor in the cost of living. And there's simply no dispute that, on average, the cost of living in right-to-work states is significantly lower than in non-right-to-work states. Taxes are higher in non-right-to-work states. Study after study that factors in cost of living differences shows that, on average, employees' real earnings and incomes are higher in right-to-work states than in forced unionism states. For example, a National Institute of Labor Relations research study using a cost of living index published by Congressional Quarterly found that the average cost of living adjusted weekly earnings in right-to-work states in 2005 were 723 compared to 688 in non-right-to-work states. And the same disparity continues to this day. But the issue isn't economics. The issue is freedom. Should people be forced to accept representation from organizations that they oppose? Should people be forced to financially subsidize organizations that they oppose? Mr. Patineau talks about taxes, compares this union dues to taxes. But unions are not the government, as Supreme Court Justice Powell said in the Abboud case. Would you, as becoming a public employee, want to be required to support the party that's in power? A political party, like a union, is a private organization. And the Supreme Court has held repeatedly that political patronage for public government jobs is unconstitutional under the First Amendment. The same result should apply to unions. Mr. Patineau talks about unions having to file LM2s with the federal government about their expenditures. Yes, but the categories and the type of detail required in those federal forms is not the same information that is necessary to tell an employee, a non-member, who wants to object to union political spending, how much the union is spending on lawfully chargeable activities and lawfully non-chargeable activities. For a specific example, the LM2 does not require unions to separate out the amount that they, the portion of their expenses that they use in organizing. And the Supreme Court held in a Railway Labor Act case called Ellis, another foundation case, that organizing is not lawfully chargeable to objecting non-members. So a non-member can't find out what the union's spending on organizing from the LM2s. It's lumped in with contract administration and collective bargaining. Finally, firing during organizing. The statistics Mr. Patinode cites are statistics with regard to union charges of people being unlawfully fired during organizing. It's not the number that have been where employers have been found liable. And quite frankly, it doesn't matter whether employers engage in unlawful activities during organizing campaigns as to whether somebody should be forced to join a union or pay money to a union. Those charges are considered by the National Labor Relations Board, and if an employer is unlawfully firing people during organizing campaigns, they're going to be found guilty, they're going to be found liable, and the company will pay a price for it, either simply having to rehire the employee and pay back wages, or in many cases, a bargaining order is issued by the board. So most of what Mr. Patinode talks about are red herrings. The issue is whether employees should be forced to accept a union that they don't want, don't like, to represent them and to pay money to them. And one final point, if you are an employee who does a better job, you cannot go to your employer and ask your employer to pay you more than that union contract provides. You are stuck with the average or the minimum. You cannot negotiate for yourself. And I think that's a very, very bad thing.
Just so we're clear, I'm not a lawyer. Never been to law school. I'm just a working stiff who happens to have lived some of the things that Ray refers to, and you can call me Ron, please. Mr. Patinode, so formal. That I've lived the stuff that I'm talking about, that I've seen what happens in the workplace, and that the idea that an individual can bargain their own contract is absolutely insane, ludicrous, and BS. I worked it for an employee, a Catholic hospital in the area, although they weren't very Christian, who regularly tried to do what, before we brought the union in, what was known as merit pay. They would put an amount of money into a pool and they would say, that's the money that we're going to divvy up. And then they would give us these evaluations that were based on a supervisor who might not like you because you might do things like say, gee, that's unsafe. I don't think we should do that. It's really absurd to think that someone could bargain a different and better wage with an employer if there were not a union there. Unless we go back to the old days where maybe women get hit on sexually or the, you know, other perks they might be asked for in exchange for such benefits. The idea that it doesn't matter if an employer fires people, to me, indicates the attitude of the National Right to Work Foundation in that it's all about having unions out. And that's pretty much it. Freedom of speech. I've been, long before I was an officer with my local, I attended many events. I attended events in Detroit at our international headquarters and at conventions where I verbally disagreed with the leadership on such things. It's the United Auto Workers. So I would go and I would disagree on things about like their opposition to improving miles per gallon requirements on cars and stuff. You can have freedom of speech in a union and nothing's going to happen to you. Trust me, no one has brought up more unpleasant things to the leadership above me than I have. The idea that the Hudson Report doesn't matter, I'm confused, because there are five categories, and those five categories are broken down. In those five categories, it has political, et cetera, et cetera. We do not spend any money politically that is not approved by the membership, because the membership in our organization, there is a small amount that we are allowed to do on a state level. On a national level, we have what's known as a cap council, where we have to voluntarily donate money. So if I'm voluntarily donating money, I don't see how that is interfering with my right. If I decide that there's something that they're doing I don't like, I stop doing that donation. It's an extra donation above my dues. I just feel that the presentation that the National Rights to Work Foundation is funded by individuals and different small groups and stuff, again, I will put those on the thing. They're funded by organizations that also fund wonderful places like the Cato Institute, the Heritage Foundation, very right-wing, vehemently anti-union organizations who are using their nonprofit status to funnel money into a foundation whose sole purpose is, by their own admission at times, to destroy unions. I mean, check out their website. Check out the web. There is tons of information available on this organization. Please do not just take things at face value. Look up unions. I did not have anything to do with the union until I'm 54. I know, hard to believe, right? And I did not get involved with the union until 12 years ago. And at that time, our employer was terrorizing us. They were, you know, firing people indiscriminately long before we even wanted to join a union. I worked in a mental health facility where if there was a problem, the immediate solution was to fire somebody. There was no due process. If we're going to talk about things like the First Amendment and freedom of speech, let's talk about due process in the workplace, which without a union is pretty rare. With the idea that I'm really just, there's so much here I could go on forever. I just like to say that I think that the idea that, you know, he's talking about union propaganda, we have to put a notice out to our members about their rights to, 2 seconds, their rights to be a member or to be an agency fee payer. That is clearly spelled out. Every single member of mine receives that information. It is in a clear form, not in an annual publication. We send them letters explaining the benefits of joining the union, and we also send a letter that explains their rights, responsibilities, and I don't know of any employer that does anything remotely like that. Thank you.
I think both of our debaters, we have plenty of time for questions. I just want to let them know that classes start at 1 o'clock, so if part of your audience starts to leave, it's nothing personal. But questions?
I guess we answered.
Okay. Well, I've got a question, then I'll prime the pump here. it's sort of indicative of our current public state of public discourse that it's either or. It's either no unions or unions. And it seems to me that we've precluded a third path, which is there another model out there? Did the Wagner Act, you know, 70 years ago, 80 years ago, sort of set in place a model that may have worked in the industrial 1930s, but doesn't really work that great in the post-industrial 2010s? Could we conceptualize of a different kind of labor relations or management labor interaction, not so much based on unions and locals and a shop that has, you know, only the workers, but recognizing that there's a unity and interest between the success of the business and the success of the workers. Without a successful business, no successful workers. And at the same time, you can't just have a dog-eat-dog world where freedom of contract is the only thing that a worker can rely on, because I think Ron's right. That's a load. I mean, no one's going to be able to really, most of your rank-and-file workers aren't going to be able to stand up for themselves without a pretty strong say, statutory frameworks telling work employers what they can and cannot do. And plus, an enlightened employer knows they need workers who are on board with the program, who are going to pull together and make everybody rich. So I'd like to have your thoughts on that. I mean, is the Wagner Act, has it ossified labor law? Is there another way forward? Are there creative things that I'm not aware of? I'm not a specialist here, but are there creative things on the management side or labor side that find a way around issues that you have problems with?
Well, a couple of points. First, we have another model in the private sector. We have another model. Today, I think it's something like 7% of employees are represented by unions. Used to be about 30%. So you've got 90 plus percent who don't have unions, who are protected by the various federal and state labor statutes and employment statutes. Their rights are protected by statute. They don't need unions. Otherwise, they'd be joining them, wouldn't they? Another possibility is unions representing only their members. That's what occurs in labor relations in a lot of countries in Europe. It's actually legal under the Wagner Act. It's the unions who seek to represent the people that don't want anything to do with the union. They haven't exercised their rights to try to get employers to agree to represent a minority union representing only its members. Or it could be a majority if a majority of the employees in the union want to be in the union. So there are other options.
Regarding the idea that we used to be 30%, now we're 7, let's talk reality. The reality is that when we were 30%, we set the standard, and that other employers, non-union employers, had to pay fairly comparable wages and benefits in order to attract better workers. Now, what's happened over the years is you mentioned the Wagner Act. It was an act that was intended to chip away at union rights, in our opinion. And now that we're down to 7%, we have the Walmarts who are setting the standard. Now, I don't know about all you young folks here, but I certainly don't want to have to work for Walmart wages for the rest of my employment lifetime. And that's what's happening, because now the standard is being set by Walmart, and it's a race to the bottom. The jobs that have been shipped overseas, the just reduction in wages, the idea that we don't need health care benefits through our employer, yet the employers were some of the people who fought the hardest against any change in trying to put in a national health care system. These are all things that are led by a business community who has gone out of control, who are dealing with nothing but greed and avarice in their dealings. They don't care about employees. They don't care about individuals. The days of employers who were responsible, who felt that their workers really contributed to the bottom line, are disappearing as we speak. The idea that's going to change without some real strong union presence to help push it, I believe, is wrong.
Yes. Question.
Okay. The first question is to Ron. Okay.
A two-parter?
The union is somewhat a protector of a person, employee, right?
I'm sorry?
Union, if you're a part of a union, isn't it somewhat a protector of your job so that person will not fire you because there's a lot of at-will employees out there?
If you're an at-will employee, that means that you are at-will coming to work and that your employer can at-will tell you not to come to work at any time for any reason. And just as an aside, the idea that there are federal regulations and laws and stuff that Ray speaks to are, as next to unenforceable. He talks about unions having, if you want to not belong to a union, how expensive it is, et cetera, et cetera. There's nothing more expensive than trying to get one of those laws enacted. Or have it acted on, rather, to prosecute on it.
So at-will employees just get fired for no unknown reason. They just don't like the look or the clothes you wear, they can just fire you.
They can fire you because they're having a bad morning.
And you have no rights to
Not unless you could prove something like discrimination, which, quite frankly, the Massachusetts Commission Against Discrimination and the national organization, which is the executive office of I forget what, has literally, you know, you'll die before you get a decision from either of those organizations.
Yeah.
If I can address that, my point is not that unions might not protect you. If you think a union's going to protect you, join it. I just think the person who thinks that the union can't protect them or won't do a good job or just doesn't like that union for some other reason should have the right not to join and not pay money to that union. Voluntary unions exist in the 22 right-to-work states. People join it if the union is doing a good job protecting them, and they don't join if the union is not doing a good job.
In the back.
That's my only point. Freedom.
In terms of alternative with labor relations, is there anything that can be done to make unions accountable? My daughter was a member of the teachers union, and she was an untenured teacher. And what she found is that the union treated untenured teachers like second-class brothers and sisters. Willingly sacrificing them when the budget cuts came, et cetera. What, if anything, can be done to make unions accountable if they're supposedly accountable to the membership?
The question is whether what could be done to make unions accountable even to their own membership?
Yeah, to their own membership and to the mission of protecting supposedly all members.
Well, I'm a libertarian, so, you know, I mean, you could have government agencies regulate unions more heavily, but I'm not in favor of that. If unions are voluntary, they're going to be self-regulated, because they want people to join, and they're going to do a good job. That's how it works in right-to-work states.
I take a slight offense at the idea that I don't do a good job. My phone rang for the last time last night at 11:30 at night with a member's concern. I was up at a discharge meeting this morning at 8:30, and I represent all my members fairly and equally. And the way that you can address what you're talking about, sir, is to do what our people need to do in their government also, and that's to participate. You have the right to participate if you're a union member. You have the right to be on a bargaining committee. You have a right to help bargain a contract and put the articles in there that you would like to see.
I'm not suggesting, Ryan, that you're not a good union leader. My point is that power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Where unions don't have to do a good job to keep their membership, many union leaders don't do a good job. I represented blue-collar workers employed by the city of Albuquerque. These were guys who repaired the garbage trucks, who fixed the traffic lights, and they didn't oppose the union because they were Republicans and the union was a Democratic union. They opposed the union. In fact, they were all supporters of the same candidates the union supported. They opposed the union because it didn't do a good job. They were forced to pay money to this union that didn't do a good job, didn't bring grievances, was in bed with management. That was made possible because New Mexico does not have a right-to-work law. Had that union been forced to do a good job to keep people in it, it would have done a better job.
Can I rebut that with one little thing? There's something called a DFR. It's a duty of fair representation charge that can be filed against a union. I've had two of them filed against me in the 12 years, well, in the 6 years I've been president. Both of them were found to have no merit. We have a duty to represent all of our members, and any member who feels that they have not been given proper representation can file a charge with the National Labor Relations Board. And that is a remedy that certainly Ray doesn't mention with his New Mexico.
Well, actually, I did mention the duty of fair representation in my remarks. The problem with the duty of fair representation is the courts give great deference to the union. The union can, in fact, under the duty of fair representation, discriminate against some employees on behalf of others if it's not a violation of some discrimination statute.
I think we have time for one last question. Yes. Sorry, Bruce.
I just want to remark that the one of the tests of whether or not the Cato Heritage, the Right to Work Foundation, are in any way looking out for workers is their attack on the Postal Service Union. Postal Service should be the poster child for exactly what you're advocating, which is because it's an open shop. And in the Northeast, union membership is like 92-95%. In the right-to-work states, particularly the South, union membership in my union, the Letter Carriers Union, is something like 87-85%, somewhere down there. A significant drop-off in membership, exactly the same working conditions, exactly the same national bargaining unit, exactly the same employer, exactly the same effort made by the union leaders, and the voluntary nature is exactly the same. Everywhere in America, it's a voluntary decision to join my union, as well as the other three unions in the Postal Service. And yet your organization and your founders are constantly attacking our unions. So it doesn't make sense to say you're in favor of our model and then just attack the fact that we voluntarily created our unions and we're very strong.
I'm sorry, the Right to Work Foundation has never attacked the Postal Service Union unless we represented a worker in a lawsuit or an unfair labor practice charge committed by some union official.
And you can only take cases of my members. I was a president of the union for 12 years. Before that, after the member of the union, you haven't taken any of my particular members. But nationwide, you take cases of members of these unions who are voluntarily in the union.
No.
Take their cases as
No. The cases we bring against the Postal Service Union are cases on behalf of non-members who haven't joined the union, but who have been discriminated against or otherwise abused because they're not members.
Our model, the same model, you cannot be discriminated against. You take the cases of members of unions in order to destroy the union.
That's not true. We represent non-members.
You'll never destroy it, but you take these cases in order to drive a wedge between the union and the workers.
I challenge you to find cases in our that are mentioned on our website. By the way, Ron said, go to our website, nrtw.org, www.nrtw.org. I challenge you to find a case on that website discussed where we have represented union members. We represent those people who don't want to be associated with the union, but who are forced to associate with it. And we bring cases against voluntary unions where the unions use the power of monopoly bargaining to discriminate and otherwise abuse those employees.
Representing wanted to cut their own contract.
Well, that may be in some cases, but they had something happen to them.
Discriminating unless it's about the right to cut your own contract. No. Otherwise, they're going to be covered by our contract.
That's the point. They're covered by your contract.
And when they file a grievance, we have to take that grievance.
But
we have to defend their rights that we've negotiated with the employer that they have, such as wages, hours, working conditions, grievance procedure, the right to uniform allowance, the right to an eight-hour day. All these things they're getting to piggyback on, and you want to take a lawsuit from them?
Yeah, because they have agreements. For example, because the union filed a grievance for a member for a job for which that non-member was entitled under the contract. That's happened.
Overwritten. We have one of the biggest contracts in the country and the world, and you can't find a single application that isn't in writing. So everything's covered. And what people have to do in the Postal Service is abide by the contract, and no one can be discriminated against.
Okay, I'm going to give Ron a chance. Do you want to chime in on this? Because I think we need to wrap it up.
John was doing a great job.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay. He was defending himself.
Well, the Right to Work Foundation, yet they go after us anyway. Heritage,
well, now, wait a minute. We have maybe 0.01% of our cases have been against the postal unions. I don't know what. Heritage doesn't even file lawsuits, as far as I know.
No, I just mean to go after. She testified against us in Congress. She testified.
I've never testified against.
No, I knew Cato.
Well, we're not responsible for Cato. Why are you attacking me for what?
They just take their money.
All right. I want to thank you all very much and thank the Federalist Society for hosting this event.
Thank you.
Have a good day.